Okay, well, this week we're going to be picking it up in Joshua 15. What we did last week, starting in Joshua 13, is we see Yahweh coming to Joshua and saying, Joshua, you're old. But there's much land that remains to be taken. He was probably about 85 at that time. The lands are kind of listed, or not kind of, but are listed. There's the Philistinian area, southwest on the coast, southwest part of Israel around Gaza. There's up in the northeast, there's the Golan area up northeast of the Sea of Galilee. There's the Egypt, there's the area down by Egypt in the southwest. There's the Gath area that's known for the giants, the Anakim. Northwest up by Sidon and all of Lebanon. So there's plenty of spaces left and cities left that haven't been taken. And Yahweh says, so apportion the land to the 9.5 tribes that are to be settled west of the Jordan. And this passage goes on to talk about east of the Jordan, Moses had already apportioned to Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. And even over there, there are some people that have not yet been driven out, and they need to be. And the passage we looked at said it more than once, that no portion was to be given to Levi, that their inheritance is Yahweh, the God of Israel, that's himself, and their role of priests for him. And so as we move from chapter 13 to 14, we saw the apportionment begin. The ones that were overseeing the apportionment was Joshua, along with Eleazar the priest, and the heads of the tribes, and they gathered together, and they would apportion the lands by use of the lot, which really then it was done by Yahweh himself, because they would bring before Yahweh what was to be done, and through the lot, Yahweh would reveal that to them. And Joseph, it said, had two tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, which were his two sons. They did this at Gilgal. Gilgal had become their center of operations. And the first tribe to come up was Judah. And as they come up, Caleb speaks up. And Caleb in his speaking up is kind of a joy. The times that it comes up. One time it came up was when they were finishing the task of spying out the land to decide. The intention wasn't to decide if they were going into the land of milk and honey, into the promised land, but to spy it out so they could see how good the land was. But they come back wanting to reject it, and Caleb did a good job of supporting the idea that Yahweh told us he would give us this land, he'll give it to us, let's go. But that did not win the day. As a result of his speaking up then, he now has an opportunity to speak up here at apportionment, because he reminds Joshua of the promise of Yahweh that was to him as a result of the spying assignment and then his subsequent support of Yahweh. And so Caleb recounts Moses sending out the 12, and for his faith in God's promise to give them the land, God promises to him the land that he covered. And he said, now it's 45 years later, and I'm 85, but I'm still as strong and able of a warrior as I was then. And that's certainly something some of us would definitely have to work at not coveting. So he says, give me the hill country where the Anakim are, which are the ones that are descendants of those that were very large in stature, giants. And they're there, and they're in fortified cities. I'll drive them out. And so Joshua honors that. Of course he did. It was God's command and promise. He pronounces blessings on Caleb, and he gives him that requested portion of land. And that included Hebron. And it belonged to Caleb up to the time of writing, according to chapter 14. We get a little history of Hebron. It was originally named Kiriath Arba. And the Arba, it was the greatest of the Anakim, the large people. The word Hebron means association. And we looked at a little bit of history in the class about Hebron. Abraham had traveled to Hebron after parting with Lot, and David made Hebron the capital after Saul was gone and before they took Jerusalem and made Jerusalem the capital. And Abraham's family burial ground was near here. So Hebron was a significant area. And that takes us through Joshua 13 and 14. And so now let's go over to Joshua 15. And we're going to look at verses 1 and 2 and then skip down and look at verse 12. I'm going to do some skipping around today. When we get to chapters 15 and the apportionment, there's a lot of detail given, and it's great detail. Part of the challenge is that it talks about names and places and this border to that border, and much of this information about where these places were is lost. Hopefully you already had or picked out one if you didn't, the handout this morning. It's one we've used before, briefly. I'm going to use it again today. It's the better one for what we're going to talk about. And that, we will look at the handout and look at the general areas where these apportionments were made, but I'm not going to read through all of these name places that most of them, we just don't know exactly where they might have been. We got some general ideas, but so, let me read verses 1 and 2, and then I want to skip down and read verse 12. Now the time for the tribe of the son, I'm sorry, now the lot for the tribe of the sons of Judah, according to their families, reached the border of Edom, southward to the wilderness of Zin, at the extreme south. Their south border was from the lower end of the Salt Sea, from the bay that turns to the south. And then it goes on and talks about it, then it proceeded southward and so on. But I'm going to skip down to verse 12. The west border was at the Great Sea, even its coastline. This is the border around the sons of Judah according to their families. And Judah received a very large chunk of land. And the white area, this one down here, is the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea, kind of down at the bottom. And then if you go up toward the top, the smaller one is the Sea of Galilee. And you can see they basically start at the north side of the Sea of Galilee and go clear down and even off of this map, down near the area approaching Egypt. So they have this area that runs clear to the Mediterranean on one side and the Dead Sea on the other, and then south and southwest from there. And I'll mention it now. We'll talk about it more at another time as we go through this morning. We're not going to get to the allotment for Simeon today. You can see it on the map. Yes, it's there. Yes, it's within the area of Judah. But that allotment actually comes somewhat later in the timeline of doing the allotments. So as it was initially given, the area that you see that says Simeon was also a part of the initial boundaries and chunk of land and included various cities that were that was the allotment for the tribe of Judah. Okay? So that's what happens. They come and they're making this allotment. We're going to go back and get more information now about what happened as Caleb spoke up. But at this point, any question, comment? Okay, let's skip down. I'm going to read verses 13 through 19 of chapter 15. Now he gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, a portion among the sons of Judah, according to the command of the Lord to Joshua, namely Kiriath Arba, Arba being the father of Anak, that is Hebron. Caleb drove out from there the three sons of Anak, Sheshal, and Ahiman, and Talmai, the children of Anak. Then he went up from there against the inhabitants of Debir. Now the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, the one who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captures it I will give him Achsa, my daughter, as a wife. Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, captured it. So he gave him Achsa, his daughter, as a wife. And it came about that when she came to him, she persuaded him to ask her father for a field. So she alighted from the donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you want?" Then she said, "Give me a blessing. Since you have given me the land of the Negev, give me also springs of water." So he gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. And so we take a deviation for a moment here. I don't know if deviation is the right word, but we stop and we get a picture of what happened with Caleb as he was given a portion of this same land in the southern part of Judah. Caleb was from the tribe of Judah, so it fits in with that. And so he gets this land of Kiriath Arba. We talked about it later. Talked about earlier, and later it's called Hebron. And he was successful in driving out the three sons of Anak, the ones that were the ones in power there. And then next he goes up to Debir, which was formerly Kiriath Sefer, the city, and that means city of the book. Why the city of the book? I don't know, but that's what the words mean. And so Caleb's up there around this city, and he's looking to take it. And he offers a prize for the one that would come and take the city. And he says, "Whoever will do this, I'm going to give him a portion within my land," and that is, I got offline on my notes. He said, "Whoever does this and takes it, I'm going to give him my daughter, Achsa, for his wife." Now, we're not as in tune as for the way things work politically and structurally and with prominence and power and position, but he's basically saying, this doesn't just mean you become my son-in-law, but this will be a great position within the lands that he's taken. So by becoming his son-in-law, by being given his daughter for a wife, Caleb is giving him a lot of prominence in the area and probably even influence in the area. And so Othniel, who is Caleb's younger brother's son, by the way, I said younger brothers because if you looked over in Judges chapter 1, it recounts a lot of this in just a few verses. It basically goes through a very similar account as you what see here in Joshua 15. So I'm not going to go read it, but in verse 13, it says he was the son of Caleb's younger brother. And so it would be his nephew. And he takes up the challenge. He captures the city, and Caleb kept his word and gave him his daughter as a wife. Now in verse 18, you have to read that carefully because very few words to explain a lot of things that happened right here. Because it says that she persuaded Othniel, his father-in-law, Caleb, and asked him to go to him and get a field for us, for me. And apparently he does. That's not said, but apparently he does. And apparently Caleb goes along with that and grants her the field. Because in the last half of verse 18, this is what it says. he comes up on the donkey, and Caleb says, "What do you want?" And you know, when you read this out loud, you could put all kinds of connotations with that by the inflection that you use. "What do you want?" versus "What do you want?" Clearly, he's very favorable toward his daughter, because her answer is, "Give me a blessing. I'm here for blessing. You have given me the land of the Negev." So this confirms that the land was given, the field was given. Also, this is the additional request, "Give me springs of water." And he was very generous in what he did. It says he gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. I was hoping that as I would try to research that, I would find out that that was kind of a known area around the Negev, the upper springs and the lower springs. What I was able to conclude is that most folks would say that meant she got some water in the hill country and she got some water in the valley. Don't really know what it was, but it was spring water. That's pretty clear. And that's a big deal down in the Negev area, because the Negev was a very arid area most of the time. And so if you've got springs, you've got water that is going to be more reliable as a source for what you need, for whether it's crops or just water so you can live or handle livestock. And so she received two areas of spring water that would be available for her and her husband to use as they build their presence there in the area of the land that Caleb has given them. So that's where they were. That was a very generous gift. And so this gives us an idea of what happened with Caleb after he got the ground that he asked for in the apportionment. And so as the promise that he was given by God clear back 40 some years ago, when God made this promise to Caleb, and we're going to see later if we get that far, and I'm pretty sure we will. The similar promise was also made to Joshua, and that is also fulfilled, but that'll come up later. So now, well, let me just stop. What comments do you have? What, any questions? Okay. Well, then go on. Let's look in chapter 15. We're going to look at verse 21, and then we're going to go down and read verses 61 to 63. So in 15:21, it says, "Now the cities at the extremity of the tribe of the sons of Judah toward the border of Edom in the south were Kabzeel and Eder and Jaguar," and it goes on and keeps on listing cities in various areas and in various groups, all the way down through that passage. And then when we get down to verse 61, it says this, and it finishes the list of cities to begin with. "In the wilderness, Beth Araba, Midden, and Sekakah, and Nibshan, and the city of Salt, and Engadai, six cities with their villages. Now, as for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the sons of Judah could not drive them out. So the Jebusites live with the sons of Judah at Jerusalem until this day." And so after the apportionment, remember God first came to Joshua and said, "You're old." And what else did he say from last week?
There's still a lot of land to be conquered.
Yeah, there's still a lot of people that haven't been driven off yet. And God's solution was, or I don't know if I want to say solution, but God's direction was apportion the land. And so Joshua gets about apportioning the land. I think it's fair to know and believe that as a part of the apportionment, the idea is then within this apportionment, the tribe that gets it will go ahead and finish the task. And Jerusalem got a lot here. I tried to work through the list of cities. I was going to count them and do other things. And you can read it if you want, but there's some wording in places. You don't know if it says, well, that was 29 cities so far, or there was another group of 29 cities. That's back in verse 32, in addition to the ones listed. And numerous people struggled with all of that because there's really 33 cities in that list. And so is that an additional 29 cities? Probably so. Maybe smaller burgs or whatever. But an interesting thing in verse 47, in terms of the size of this area they're given, it says this. Ashdod, its towns and its villages, which included Gaza, as far as the brook of Egypt and the great sea, even its coastline. Okay, as far as what? the Brook of Egypt. Now, so clearly that's not the Nile. That's a brook. That's a creek. I should have looked at this, but I didn't. What are some of your other versions say? Do all of them say Brook of Egypt? Yeah, Brook, okay. So, where is that and what is it? I mean, probably it's close to Egypt. It was quite a territorial area. And then we get down to verse 63. The Jebusites were in Jerusalem, and they had a problem. And the text says they could not drive them out. And as a result, the Jebusites, at the time that Joshua was written, still live there. Now, who were the Jebusites? Well, they were Canaanites. And so they're part of the descendants of Ham through Canaan. They're Canaanites. They're one offshoot. They are people that should have been driven out. We get our first introduction to the city that's now called Jerusalem and was called Jerusalem at the time that Joshua was written. It was called Salem at one time, right? And what's the connection with Salem that we saw clear back in the book of Genesis? Do you remember? Melchizedek. And Abraham, after chasing off some kings that had come and taken Lot and a couple of cities and whatever, Abraham had got his crew together and went out and defeated them. They're bringing back the people and everything that was stolen. And Melchizedek comes out to greet Abraham. And how is Melchizedek described?
Priest of Salem.
The priest of Salem. Was he just a priest? What's that? He was the king of Salem. So he was the chief person from Salem. And there's a whole lot going on there as far as Melchizedek and his spiritual role and so on. But Salem, as we look at Salem, now being called Jerusalem, see the Salem in there? The makeup of the city is probably at least somewhat different. And he may have been over the same general people group, but he was a priest of who? Most High God. That's how the scriptures talk about it. The Jebusites weren't worshipers of the Most High God. And so at least by this time, it's not a city that you would want to say, hey, I'm from Salem, we're the best. No, it didn't work that way by the time we get here and its name is Jerusalem. And so the only real information we're given is that the tribe of Judah was not successful in clearing it out. I will tell you that after Joshua dies, Judah does go up and defeat them, and they burn it, but it doesn't hold. Later, the tribe of Benjamin will have to go back again. As Benjamin gets their allotment, Jerusalem is very close or in it, and the tribe of Benjamin will have to go back again and take the city, but they're unable. The defeat of Jerusalem actually waits until David defeats the city after he's been reigning for about 8 years and moves his capital up there. That's found in 2 Samuel. And he actually reigned from Jerusalem for 33 years. And what's the capital of Israel today? Depends on what argument you want to have, but in general speaking, in their minds, it's Jerusalem, and that's what they want to be their capital because of the history behind it. So there's probably good comments to make about the fact that Judah, it's written here, could not displace those people. Does that sound like what you would expect? How does this fit in with what we've been studying so far?
God is fighting for them, but this puts the blame on the people of Judah.
when God comes to Joshua and says, okay, you're old, there's still land to take, a portion to the people, Joshua had success at every turn, didn't he? Yeah, I mean, he did. And they had the one problem at Ai, but we can look back and see why they had that problem. They forgot who was fighting for them. They forgot who was designing the fight, who was laying out the direction of the fight, who was giving both, given the strategic orders as well as just the implementation orders about how to carry out this battle. When they tried to do it on their own, they didn't do so well. And so this raises a lot of questions that the text doesn't directly answer. But what was the promise of God to the people of Israel before Joshua was even in charge, when it was Moses? What was the promise?
He would give them the land.
I'll clear these people out before you. Who is the active party? It's God himself. And so you can't help but look at this and at least question, if not firmly believe, that there's some flaw in the leadership in the tribe of Judah regarding taking this land. And it probably is an extremely accurate statement made when it says that Judah could not drive them out. What's missing from that statement? How is it similar to Ai? Who did they depend on when they went up to Ai?
Themselves.
And they said so. It's not very big. We're not going to need very many people. 2,000 to 3,000 ought to take care of it. They send up 3,000 and they can't run fast enough to get home. And here they are. And who does it say tried to do it? Now, we could probably easily read too much into that text. I don't know. But it says Judah could not drive them out. And there is no comment made about how they responded to that, why they couldn't drive them out. God's thoughts about it are not listed. But it certainly has every appearance with this simple accounting that they went over with their soldiers and said, it's our responsibility, we'll do it, and just simply couldn't. I think there might be a lesson in that for some of us from time to time. From time to time, meaning every morning when we get up to every night when we go to bed. Because we so often look at life out of what we have. We look at our own resources, our own abilities, our own connections, who do we know? Where can I go get something that'll make this situation I'm working on complete in the right way? And you know, we're blessed a lot. We're successful at many turns. But when the crisis comes, then hopefully we're praying. We should have been praying all the way through. Lord, how do you want me to handle this? Where do you want me to turn to? And we had some things come up in the Thursday Bible study I teach, and as a result we were encouraging people to go read The Hiding Place, and talked about some other examples. We were aimed at a particular aspect of that, but if you want to think about, understand what it means to query God and to look for direction from God about how to take care of a crisis, it's a good book to read. I would encourage you to do so. Questions, comments? Okay. Well, let's turn over to then chapter 16. And once again, there's a lot of territorial description that I'm not going to go into. But first, let's read verses 1 through 5. Then the lot for the sons of Joseph went from the Jordan at Jericho to the waters of Jericho on the east into the wilderness, going up from Jericho through the hill country to Bethel. It went from Bethel to Luz and continued to the border of the Arkites and the Ataroth. It went down westward to the territory of the Japhelites, as far as the territory of lower Beth Horon, even to Gezer, and it ended at the sea. The sons of Joseph, Manasseh and Ephraim, received their inheritance. Now this is the territory of the sons of Ephraim, according to their families. The border of their inheritance eastward was Ataroth Adar, as far as the upper Beth Horon. Now I'm going to quit there, and it keeps talking about the border, but we're under in verse 5, Ephraim. So in the first five verses that I read, we get a picture of the entirety for what's going to go to Joseph's offspring, Joseph's tribe, but then it's divided into two. So in the first five verses, we see Ephraim and Manasseh all together. Okay? And there's going to be some further alterations that happen downstream of this discussion here, minor alterations, but alterations nonetheless. And so that's the combined area in those first four verses. And then we go down through the map. I go down through the description, and it starts laying out, okay, now with regard to Ephraim, here's what they got. And so it lays all of that out to identify how you would make that border for Ephraim. But go down to verse 10. What they did not drive out, this is Ephraim, the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. So the Canaanites live in the midst of Ephraim to this day, and they became forced laborers. Do you see a pattern beginning to develop? When these tribes are going to the effort of completing the taking of the land, often, many times, there are areas that they don't succeed. And as a result, we get statements like that, and they live there to this day, meaning at the time that this was written. So, let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 20 for a moment. We read it in other places when we were going through this study, but this is an easy place to go get it in concise form. Deuteronomy 20, and I'm going to read verses 16 through 18. It's no big surprise, no great super revelation, but it says it very clearly, verses 16 through 18 in chapter 20 of Deuteronomy. Only the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes, but you shall utterly destroy them. The Hittite and the Amorite and the Canaanite, the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things which they have done for their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God. When you besiege a city in a long time to make war against it, in order to capture it, you shall not destroy its trees by swinging an axe against them, for you may eat from them, and you shall not cut them down. For the tree is the field of a man. I'm sorry, for is the tree the field of a man, that it should be besieged by you? And it goes on to talk about the trees. I went one verse more than I meant. But going back to that passage, why destroy the inhabitants? Why drive them out? Why?
To limit their evil influence.
Get rid of their evil influence. And the gods that they're worshiping. What's at least implied if you don't do this? You're going to join in with them. Their evil will entice you. Your relationships with them will lead you to the idolatry that they are practicing. And God says, don't do it. Do what I'm telling you to. Cleanse the land. And so in the course of cleansing the land of the evil influences that would be a problem for the Israelite nation, they're also executing the judgment of God, because these people are idolaters They've departed from God, and they're serving other gods. And interestingly enough, when this curse is pronounced on Canaan, did Canaan know who God was? He sure should have. He was the offspring of Ham, and where had Ham been leading up to this time? He'd been on board the ark. Do you think Ham understood cleansing? He should have. Did he understand the reason for cleansing? He should have. Did he teach that to Canaan? He should have. And then Moses pronounces the curse on Canaan that you're going to serve your fellow kinsmen, which did happen as a result of not clearing them out. Sometimes they were made forced laborers. But you're going to serve your kinsmen, but here is God coming back. These Canaanite people, it wasn't that a portion of them were idolaters. It was who they all were. God doesn't need to make any exceptions because there aren't any, which is really kind of amazing if you think about it just a little bit. I mean, yes, it's been hundreds of years, but what is the heritage? How did we get here? Why do we call ourselves Canaanites? They had to have had some history, but that history did not bring them to an understanding of who Yahweh was, nor did it bring them to worship him. And the Israelites aren't going to be immune from their influence. And so this pattern that's developing is going to continue. So we saw that there was a territory for both of them in the first, both Ephraim and Manasseh, half of Manasseh, because the other half's east of the Jordan, right? They've already got their spot. And we saw that there's a territory for both of them in 16, chapter 16. The latter part of 16, we see the territory that's given to Ephraim. And now we'll go over to chapter 17 and see the territory given to Manasseh. And I'm going to read the first 11 verses. Now this was the lot for the tribe of Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph. To Machir, the firstborn of Manasseh, and the father of Gilead, were allotted to Gilead and to Bashan because he was a man of war. So the lot was made for the rest of the sons of Manasseh, according to their families, for the sons of Abiezer, for the sons of Helek, for the sons of Azrael, and for the sons of Shechem, and for the sons of Hepher, and for the sons of Shemidah. These were the male descendants of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, according to their families. However, Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons, only daughters. And these are the names of his daughters, Mahla and Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. They came near before Eleazar the priest, and before Joshua the son of Nun, and before the leaders, saying, "The Lord commanded Moses to give us an inheritance among our brothers." So according to the command of the Lord, he gave them an inheritance among their father's brothers. Thus there fell 10 portions to Manasseh, besides the land of Gilead and Bashan, which is beyond the Jordan, because of the daughters of Manasseh received an inheritance among his sons. And the land of Gilead belonged to the rest of the sons of Manasseh. The border of Manasseh ran from Asher to which is east of Shechem. Then the border went southward to the inhabitants of En-Tappuah. The land of Tappuah belonged to Manasseh, but Tappuah on the border of Manasseh belonged to the sons of Ephraim. The border went down to the brook of Cana, southward of the brook. These cities belonged to Ephraim among the cities of Manasseh, and the border of Manasseh was on the north side of the brook, and it ended at the sea. The south side belonged to Ephraim, the north side to Manasseh, and the sea was their border. And they reached to Asher on the north and to Issachar on the east. In Issachar and in Asher, Manasseh had Beth Shean and its towns, and Iblim and its towns, and the inhabitants of Dor and its towns, and the inhabitants of Endor and its towns, and the inhabitants of Taanach and its towns, and the inhabitants of Megiddo and its towns. The third is Napeth. Okay, A lot of words there, but basically this is the territory for the firstborn of Joshua, and it starts out saying, well, there's this person Machir, the firstborn of Manasseh, the father of Gilead, and Gilead and Bashan were given to him because he was a man of war. Now, the firstborn of Manasseh being Machir doesn't mean the person Machir is there. This is the family of Machir. These people, when you think of Machir, you think of a man of war because the people in the family were men of war, and they apparently had distinguished themselves. And so when the time came to disperse to the families, the land area that went to Manasseh, the first piece went to the family of Machir, and they got Gilead and Bashan because of their expertise and success in the war. And then in verse 2 it says, the lot was made for the rest after the portion for the family of Machir. So they take that out. Now we're dispersing the rest. But the daughters of Zelophehad speak up. Zelophehad had no sons, and they had already appealed back in Numbers to Moses, saying, when we get into the land, we deserve an inheritance. It's not fair that we didn't have a brother. And so we're deprived of an inheritance, meaning a chunk of land that will be in our family that will be passed down from generation to generation to generation. And so Moses took that to God, and God said, yeah, that's fine. They're right. They deserve an inheritance, so when they get there, they will get an apportionment like their brothers, the other men in the tribe, get. And one of the issues came up then. This happened back in Numbers, not here, but an issue came up back in when Moses is dealing with this. It said, well, wait a minute. If they go marry some man from another tribe, now when we get to the year of Jubilee, we're going to have other tribes owning ground within our area. And so the conclusion is, when you marry, you have to marry within your tribe. There, now that kept everything whole. Everybody seemed satisfied. And so now they're apportioning the land, and the daughters of Zelophehad speak up. Hey, whoa, remember, we've got a promise in here that we're going to receive a portion like all the rest. They did this in front of Eleazar, Joshua, and the tribal leaders, the ones overseeing all this. They remind them of Moses' command. And so it says in verse 5, there were 10 portions for the rest of the families. So apparently there were 10 other family groups, plus one for Machir and one for the daughters of Zelophehad. And so those 12 portions were meted out. And then verses 7 through 11, I read those. We're not going to try to nail all of that down. But this describes the borders of Manasseh in relationship to other tribes, mostly Ephraim, but also some with Issachar and Asher, about some cities that were close. And it delineates, well, these are on the border. These go to Manasseh. These go to Ephraim or Issachar or Asher. And that's what verses 7 through 11 did. Questions, comments? So let's look on down now. When we get past 11, when we get past 11 and we begin with verse 12, we get some more information that's disturbing and interesting. Beginning in verse 12 of chapter 17. But the sons of Manasseh could not take possession of these cities because the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. It came about when the sons of Israel became strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. Then the sons of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, why have you given me only one lot and one portion for an inheritance, since I am numerous people whom the Lord has thus far blessed? Joshua said to them, if you are a numerous people, go up to the forest and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and of the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you. The sons of Joseph said, the hill country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who live in the valley land have chariots of iron, both those who are in Beth Shean and its towns, and those who are in the valley of Jezreel. Joseph spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, "You're a numerous people, and you have great power. You shall not have one lot only, but the hill country shall be yours. For though it is a forest, you shall clear it, and its furthest borders it shall be yours, for you shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have chariots of iron, and though they are strong." So in verse 12, we see that these cities mentioned, Manasseh struggled to possess them. And we're most likely looking back at verse 11, the ones that were close to Issachar and Asher. And so why did it say in the verses, why did it say they couldn't possess them? Or what does it say about they couldn't possess them, and what does it say about the condition? Look there in verse 12.
Canaanites were determined to stay in this land.
Yeah, my version said persisted. His said determined. A lot of times I've heard it recently with our current conflict that's going on in Iran, a war. Are wars of wills. Who's determined enough to make it happen? Now, there's a lot more to it than that. But according to the scriptures here, what was their problem? Canaanites wouldn't cooperate. No kidding. They persisted in other words, they were more determined than the Israelites were. It didn't say that they went down there and defeated them militarily. No, they were just more determined to stay than the Canaanites were, or than the Israelites were, to run them off, to kill them, to move them out. And so they were staying. And in verse 13, it does say the Israelites grew in strength, and they did put them into forced labor, but they could not drive them out completely. And so we're back to the same comments we made with regard to Judah. Why? Well, anyway, the reason why, I believe, is most likely I didn't see anything about consulting with God and following his directions and letting him fight for them. In verse 14, it says the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and half of Manasseh, come together. And they complained to Joshua. What was their complaint? Why did we just get one portion? And it says they're numerous and we're blessed by the Lord. You don't sound like you think you're blessed, but anyway. What they mean is there's lots of us. And you just gave us this one portion and we had to divide it in two. And the way it was done was one portion that was divided in two, because it was treated as though Joseph were one of the 12, which he was. And we're numerous, we're blessed by the Lord. We need more space for ourselves. What did Joshua tell them they could do? Well, if you're so big, then what? Go clear the land. And you can go up there where the Perizzites are and some other groups up in the valleys or around in the valleys where all the trees are and clear the land. It really sounds like the land, the trees, are more of an issue than the current inhabitants. It's like if you go chop down the trees, it's going to be yours. But there's apparently a little more to it than that. And so how did they reply? What did they say back to Joshua? They said several things. What did they say first?
Chariots of iron.
Well, back up just a little bit. Well, that's what we started out with, and Joshua's already told them the answer to that. Then go clear the forest. Then they said, well, wait a minute. These folks have chariots of iron. And so they're giving their reasons why I can't do what you gave, I can't take advantage of the opportunity you gave me because they've got war weapons that we don't have. Now, have they fought where they had to deal with chariots before? Yeah, the king of Hazor brought all of these armies together. And what did it say about the number of people in the armies? How did they describe the number? Do you remember?
Sand on the seashore.
Like the sand on the seashore. Didn't give a number. There's just so many of them, you couldn't count them. And what else did they have? They had chariots. And when God sent Joshua up, what did God tell Joshua about what would happen as he interacted militarily with these amassed armies? Do you remember?
Fundamentally,
he said, I'll take care of it. This time tomorrow, there will not be one king standing against you. And what did they do? They went up there, and these armies just went everywhere, and they chased them to the four corners of the Israelite earth, okay? Kind of borrowed a saying there and didn't do very well with it. But they chased them clear to the north. They chased them clear to the south. They chased them clear over to the Mediterranean Sea. And the kings went off and hid in a cave. And they came back later and took care of the kings that were these armies belonged to. So they've seen it before. We can't handle chariots of iron. We're already beat. We haven't even started. And what did Joshua answer to that? First of all, he made a statement, and I'll make the statement, and then I'll let you answer my question. He said, all right, yeah, you're right. You're numerous. You're a great power, and you will not be limited to one lot. You'll receive more. And then what does he tell them?
Mountain country.
Well, yeah, but that mountain country is the forest that he gave him the first time. You're not going to be limited. Now, go out there, take the forest, clear the forest, and you'll have it. Did I miss that? Verse 18. But the hill country but shall be yours. That's what they were already given. If you go back up, they said to them, well, maybe I did miss that.
16, the people are saying that the hill country is not enough.
Right. Yeah, they said, the hill country is not enough. And verse 18, for the hill country shall be yours. For though it is a forest, you shall clear it. And to its furthest borders it shall be yours, for you shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have chariots of iron, and even though they're strong. Joshua comes back to him and says, I already gave you the answer, and you can do it, you will do it, it's yours, go do it. He didn't really change what he was offering to them. He offered them the forest again. And that seems to be the end of that discussion. Questions? Thoughts?
County clerk to report ownership of land certainly didn't exist back then. And that's why even today in many of the wars in Israel still are fought. Because there was no clear repository in the ownership of land.
Well, and actually as we read this, that's a big part of when we look at the book and we see all this, they went from here to there to here to here. They have and they list all the cities and they list all that's a part of making a record for Israel so they'll know amongst themselves.
Standards
who got what?
Like a river running would change. It was really contentious back then.
And it could be. But here's a question I think we need to focus on in the few minutes we have left. What's happening to the faith of the Israelites regarding the promise of God within the tribes? It's dwindled. It's weak. They're looking to themselves. What is tragically missing from any of this is, why are they not seeking out God? There's no comment here about turning to God for direction, for strength. There's not interaction. Now that they've got their basic land, even though there's much left to conquer, even though within their own areas there's places left to conquer, they're kind of going back to the same old way they always did things. It is frankly very much like the crises you see. For those of you that were alive at 9/11, you didn't used to have to say that. 15, 20 years ago, you didn't have to say that. But I do today, although looking at this crowd, maybe not. But at least not for very many of you. But if you were alive on 9/11, from a standpoint of spiritual thinking of God, of the Bible, Yahweh, what happened? Do you remember any events where we sought God after 9/11?
There was a lot of churches that opened up that evening.
Yeah, there was that. But in Washington, D.C., on the steps of the Capitol, if I remember right, there were a lot of political people that came together for a time of prayer. Now, my memory's not very good, so I might be remembering a different event. But I'm pretty sure about that.
You're right.
How long did that last? It didn't take a day or two or three, and we were back to fighting like politicians again. I didn't live through World War II, but the history I've read tells me that, praise the Lord, and pass the bullets was pretty common. No atheists in foxholes. How long did it last? In many ways, this country has a good heritage, better than many. That doesn't buy you very much. You're not better. Being better than almost everybody else is not necessarily a great place to stand. Because our measurement stick is what's our faith in God. And it is, in the moments of crisis, the believer turns to God himself. When the crisis is over, we tend to go back to the things we were relying on before the crisis started. And we could fault them a lot, but I think there's a learning opportunity here for us that we need to not miss. Seek God in the crisis. If you weren't seeking him before, well, you can't plow looking backwards and be worthy of the kingdom of heaven according to Jesus himself. But as we go forward, after the crisis, we need to be people of prayer and people of faith and people of trust. And our focus needs to be the promises of God, not the hopes of this evil world. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to note as you read through the Old Testament, there's the overwhelming number of references throughout the entire Old Testament to the Exodus. There's probably in the neighborhood of close to 200 references throughout the Old Testament, including Psalms, to the Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
And so the entire problem of these people here is they were not remembering the God of the Exodus.
That's right.
They would remember that. So the writers of the Old Testament knew that, and they continued to encourage the children of Israel throughout their history up to the time of Christ by referring back to the God of the Exodus.
Yeah. And an interesting thing I read recently, I didn't think about it until Dave said that, but I read something recently about somebody that went through talking about the number of times, and I can't give you a number, I don't remember, but if you stop and think just a minute, you'll start to think of examples that the Exodus is mentioned as well in the New Testament. Jesus mentioned it. You have Moses and the prophets. Remember when Moses was lifted, you know, when Moses built the serpent, as the serpent was lifted up? That's the way I need to be lifted up. A lot of parallel teaching right there. The whole book of Hebrews is about don't be as stupid as they were. And I said that pretty strongly, but that's exactly what the book is saying. Can't you learn from them? And so the Exodus is all over the Bible. And yes, it's really all over the Old Testament, just as Dave said. All right, I will see you next week. And some of these chapters we're going to go through pretty quick. The plan I've got will take us up through about the third Sunday in May to be done with Joshua.